Welcome to Star Talk, your place in the universe where science and pop culture collide. Star Talk begins right now. Welcome to Star Talk Radio. I'm your host, Neil deGrasse Tyson. I'm an astrophysicist and director of New York City's Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. The following show features my interview with the actor Hank Azaria. It's possible that many of you may know him better for his voice than for anything else he's done. This one man has provided the voices for a broad range of characters on the animated Fox series The Simpsons. His talent for mimicry and accents has also been central to many of his other roles in movies and television. In the first part of this interview, I establish Hank's geek cred. Of course, we don't only invite geeks to be on Star Talk, but we do love to celebrate them every chance we get. And as you'll hear, Hank Azaria turns out to be a card-carrying member, and his passion for the Star Trek TV series even helped him develop his remarkable voice skills. Do you have what people might call geek credentials?
Oh, yes.
Give me some.
Okay, I'm a Star Trek freak.
Ooh.
To the point where, I mean, I grew up
watching. That counts. That's enough. You could stop there and you're in the club. But if you got more,
no,
I'm listening.
I have more specifics than that. Uh-huh. Well, first of all, I remember like loving it as a child.
Are you old enough to have seen the first run?
No. I was born in 64. I think it premiered in 66.
That's a little late. Yeah, a little late.
But it was already in reruns by the time I was 6, 7. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Especially on WPIX in New York,
you
got them all.
Yeah,
and I remember like loving it as this intense kind of science fiction adventure. Then by the time I was about 15, realizing that in many ways it was hilarious. Then it became like, you know, by the 19th time I saw certain episodes and certain like Shatner overacting moments.
Well, then you're reminded why the show got canceled for some of those episodes. Yeah.
And then in college, it continued, and we actually, those were the early days of computers. The only thing we really used the computer for was to codify all the Star Trek episodes.
Really?
Yeah, we'd have like the actual title, our title, funny moments we liked, cool things about the, yeah, it's pretty geeky.
That's geeky, okay. So you're born and raised in New York?
That's true.
Public schools?
No, I went to private
school. No, you don't sound like a private school guy. You sound like you hung out in the streets, so.
Well, I grew up in Queens, so you can't avoid the streets. But I went, you know what happened? My sisters are older than I am, and they went to public schools in Forest Hills. And one day my sister came home covered in coleslaw. There was a big brawl in the lunchroom.
Not a food fight, but a brawl.
A brawl. That she got in the middle of. She came home hysterical, crying, covered in coleslaw. And my parents were like, that's it. That's it for public schools.
No public school for you.
So I went to Montessori schools.
Ooh.
As a little guy.
Oh, okay.
And then I went to a prep school in Queens called Kew Forest for grades 7 through 12.
So are there any memorable teachers there?
Well, I had some great teachers.
Because I do a poll and I say, how many great teachers can you list in your life? And nobody has more than two or three, at most four.
Yeah.
And typically, if one of those great teachers was a science teacher, then they become a scientist. I found that interesting.
Yeah, see, I don't think I had a great science teacher. I loved science. I did. I had some pretty good ones.
Mm-hmm.
I had an amazing English teacher in high school, a great history teacher in high school. I remember in Montessori, I had one or two particularly gifted teachers that I remember very fondly. In college, I had an incredible European literature teacher.
Listen to you. European literature. Excuse me.
A guy named Saul Gittleman at Tufts University taught European literature and Yiddish literature. And they were amazing classes. People would take them just to hear him talk.
I thought Yiddish was more spoken than written. I guess not.
It's guys like Shalom Aleichem who wrote the Tevye stories originally that became
Fiddler on the Roof. Roof.
Mm-hmm. And Sholem Ash. And then into the modern tradition of like Bernard Malamud and Philip Roth.
So you read Yiddish?
No. I read all the translated stuff.
Translated, okay.
I can't speak. I can't read.
Do you know any other languages?
I don't.
So you're just American?
I'm a Sephardic Jew, which is a Spanish Jew. My parents are both fluent in Spanish. And for about a minute in high school, when we went to Spain for a month, I was fluent, but when I came back, and it's all gone. I can do accents, but I'm not so good with language.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah, because if you're good with voices, maybe having known multiple languages works the tongue and the lips, but you got there from a whole other way,
apparently. I can sound like I know the language, but I don't really know the language. My wife is linguistically very gifted.
Okay.
She speaks Italian fluently, and she can pick up a language really fast.
Polyglot, I guess, when they call those folks.
Yeah. If you want to be all technical about it.
Let me ask you, most people, I think, when they think of acting in life, they don't necessarily think of being a voice actor, right? Did that? What came first for you?
First for me came acting. I don't know many people who set out to be a voice actor only.
And you went to Tufts?
I did.
Did you major in acting there?
Yes, I majored in drama there, and there certainly was no voiceover there. We did plays. College theater is a lot of classics and experimental stuff that's very difficult to sit through.
Mm. So they're really training ground for you, and it's painful for the audience. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely, with rare exception. Mm. Well, you got people of varying talents, you know, and learning, and usually it's a very academic approach. Like there's some very intellectual concept behind the production that may not translate so much into actual enjoyable, visceral theater.
So did your teacher say, that guy Hank, he'll go far?
I certainly got a lot of the roles. Mm-hmm. I was there at a great time. I mean, Oliver Platt, you know that actor?
Yeah.
We both went to Tufts together and did a lot of theater together there. Mm-hmm. He was great. I had a lot to learn then. I was very raw. He was like, as good as he is now, he was that good then. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot from him. I found him very inspiring back then.
So when did your voice become an actor?
I was always a mimic growing up, you know, as long as I can remember.
So you could imitate people off the bat.
Captain Kirk, for example, But
while you were watching it in reruns that early, were you imitating him at the time?
Yes. I was trying to. I was always trying to record.
Because you wanted to sort of have playful mockery of it, or because you wanted to be Captain Kirk?
Both.
Really?
Absolutely both. When you find that you can sort of actually really sound like your heroes, I can actually get Captain Kirk's rhythm. You feel great about it.
I guess, right, because we all have heroes, but we have no access to their talents.
Yes.
So you had extra psychic value to your imitations.
Well, I would hear myself being able to do it, and I would delight myself with it. Like, how that actually sounded like. You know, or, I mean, Rocky came out when I was like 9, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be able to really sound like that. You know, hey, yo, well, I'm standing here. I was like, wow, I can make that noise. That's awesome. But I didn't...
Oh, so Sylvester Stallone's voice is a noise.
Well, you know, I always say that now. Because I've been doing it for so long, and it's a career, it feels to me just like noises I'm making.
So whatever you hear, you can just create it on the spot, essentially.
I found as a kid that I could pretty much instantly mimic something. And then I found later on is there were certain impressions that I couldn't get, but if I would work on them for a week or two and I would get them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, Woody Allen, for example. You know, somebody that I worked on. I couldn't get it right away. But he was a hero, a hero of mine, so I tried. Johnny Carson is another one that I couldn't do right away. But I worked on it, and it came, because it was important to me. I loved these guys so much, I really wanted to get the impression.
Okay, now you got to do Carl Sagan, now that you're sitting here.
You know, I never really worked up...
Don't tell me that! You're here on Star Talk!
Billions and billions of... What was it, stars? A journey through... That's how I remember it, anyway. Very deliberate, measured, kind of wrapped himself around the words... I'd need a few minutes to actually hear him to get it right, but it was sort of like that.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. He was into the syllables of the words he pronounced.
Since we're talking scientifically,
This
is what I wonder. You know what goes along with being able to mimic? And I only realized this like in the last decade or so. As more and more celebrities do voiceovers, but you don't know it's them while they're doing a car commercial, I can instantly pick out a voice. I'll say, okay, that's Kiefer Sutherland, or that's Scott Glenn, or that's Jeff Bridges. And I think it must be connected to the ability to mimic somehow. Voices that most people, you would say, yeah, it sounds familiar, but I don't know who that is.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if I've heard somebody once, I'll remember what their voice sounds like a long time afterwards.
All right, so now the radio audience wouldn't know this, but when you were imitating Woody Allen, you were going through the body gestures of it.
Yeah.
So I was surprised when you see the behind-the-scenes voiceovering of these animated features. You see the actors gesturing behind the microphone. I'm saying, nobody's looking at that. So I wonder, how important is your body when you're only doing voiceover?
You're as fully engaged as when you're acting.
You have to be.
You do. You have to put your whole body into it. That's what's so tiring about it. Look, it is easier than showing up on a set and getting into hair and makeup and wardrobe and shooting a 16-hour shoot day just to get 2 pages worth of dialogue on film, which is what you do in a movie or a TV show. It's easier than that, but it's so concentrated. I can only do about 3-4 hours of voiceover recording before I collapse, because your whole body is in
your
it.
Your whole body, mind, and soul.
You have to gesture and pretend you're really acting that out in order to make it sound real. Like, if you're supposed to be sounding like you're lifting a heavy object, you have to kind of go, all right, let's get that up there, you know. Or if you're supposed to sound like you're running, the easiest thing to do is just jog in place and say the lines.
So I presume it's hard to imitate someone who doesn't have obvious, unusual vocal intonations.
Yeah.
So imitation is like an illustrator trying to draw a caricature of something.
Right.
They're going to find your nose or your eyebrows or something that they have to exaggerate.
Right.
So is it really true you can't imitate someone who's got nothing interesting in their voice?
I mean, I guess you can, but it's very, very difficult. In the same way that, like, it's easier to do a very pronounced British accent, you know, a Cockney accent, than it is to do a subtle one. It's much harder. You know, and even that is probably too much. It's really difficult to do a subtle accent. It's very hard to do somebody who's got a subtle vocal quality. I can do a broad stroke impression immediately to get something really good. Like, I've had to do accents. My French accent wasn't very good when I first...
Give me
something. Role in a Lonquin Poly where I played the French guy. And I had to work at it. At first, I couldn't do it too well. But I worked on it, and it came out all right.
Oui, oui. So at what point do they choose you to do a French accent or just get some French actor?
Well, that's kind of my gig now in Hollywood. I'm known as the accent guy, so
really?
People think of me for that. Yeah.
So they'll go to you before they'll get Gerard Depardieu or
not
something?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, if they want the real deal, they'll do that. Especially for comedy. Naked foreigners, for some reason. Somebody who's not wearing too much and speaks in an accent.
That's a category.
Yeah, it's
of
a very small niche, but it seems to be my niche.
Do you prefer inventing characters out of whole cloth, or do you rather base them on people and life experiences that you've had?
You know, for me, there's no difference. I'm always sort of starting with what feels like a mimicry, an impression to me, even if it starts to get really far afield from what that person's actually like. It kind of starts with, you know, like when I did this role in The Birdcage. I played a very flamboyantly gay character, a Guatemalan. And I worked on a Guatemalan accent pretty hard, and he talked like this. He was
Wait, so Birdcage was La Cage aux Folles, wasn't
it? La Cage aux Folles.
Yeah.
The American version was The Birdcage with Ron Lloyd.
So you were in that movie?
I was.
I got to go back now, because I wouldn't know what you
looked
like.
I played the houseboy. He's a very sweet guy, talks like this, and a Latin guy. And he's, you know, very mothering and sweet to everybody. And I realized a couple of weeks into shooting that I sound exactly like my grandmother. I sounded almost exactly like...
Oh, because you have Spanish.
Yeah, she
heritage.
Was a very sweet Spanish lady. And she was very loving and nurturing and, oh, baby, I love you. And having that image of her in my mind, it helped me be feminine and maternal. It would have saved me a lot of time building that character.
Forgive me, I did not see the sequel to Night at the Museum, which was the Smithsonian.
Yes.
The original was took place
here.
Yeah. Here.
Yes.
We are interviewing you in my office at the Hayden Planetarium, the American Museum of Natural History.
Mm-hmm.
So what character were you? Forgive me for not knowing.
Khamun Ra, an Egyptian pharaoh who came back to life, and I used the voice of Boris Karloff. As an inspiration. When I say inspiration, I mean I ripped it off.
Because that's what Pharaoh spoke like. We're sure.
You know, we were playing around. You're talking about, I mean, we were playing around with, like, what should he sound like?
What the hell should he sound like?
And I first had this sort of just upper crust English accent I was using. We did the table read, and the head of the studio, actually, sometimes they have good ideas. He said, you know, can't the voice be a little sillier? And we were like, all right. So I went for a wardrobe and makeup test, and which usually doesn't involve sound. They just want to see what you look like. But we threw a mic on there, and I just threw out a bunch of voices. And as a joke, because Boris Karloff was the original mummy, I said, what about, you know, Boris Karloff was a mummy? Maybe this would be good.
With a lift.
And I was, yeah, well, he didn't really lift, he a little bit lift.
But a mummy with a lisp.
I exaggerated it. And it just made everybody laugh. They're like, that's the one. I'm like, really? That's out there. But okay. Let's give it a whirl. But actually it worked. Because Boris Karloff could be... He was a great actor, actually. He could be really menacing. Mm-hmm. He was the villain in that. So it worked pretty well.
Well, if you know this, we, to this day, have... this sounds like a cheap ad, but... We have Night at the Museum for parents and kids. So,
oh, you do?
So you spend the night in the Hall of Ocean Life, but before then they turn out the lights in the Dinosaur Hall.
Oh, really?
And you go with a flashlight and you go fossil hunting.
How with your old kids. The kids?
I think that's what I mean. The targeting
would freak my son out a little.
Like fifth through eighth grade
All right.
kind of thing.
Oh, well,
and I just learned, because I don't run these things, they now have Night at the Museum for grown-ups.
Oh, really?
You can't be younger than 21.
I can go in character and freak people out. They're dressed as an Egyptian pharaoh.
I am Ka-Moon Ra. I am half god. Once removed on my mother's side. Rightful ruler of Egypt. Future ruler of, well, everything else. Now, I have lost some men. So, I am in need of some new generals to join me in my little plan of conquering this world. Ivan the Terrible. Napoleon Bonaparte. And young Al Capone. Some of the most despicable, the most feared leaders in all of history. Gentlemen. It is just fantastic to meet you all.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the US on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, business tripper, or long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. And that's good, because there are a lot of me's. Choice Hotels has over 7,400 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. Get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. Cambria Hotels feature locally inspired hotel bars with specialty cocktails and downtown locations in the center of it all. Hey, that's me. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces to get the most of your business travel and on-site restaurants. That's me, too. And at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles, great pools for the entire family, and spacious rooms. Hey, that's me, too. I guess I'm just going to have to stay at all of them. Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travel comes true.
A black hole? I'm sorry, can we call it that?
Yes, it's the preferred term. And most scientists believe that what enters a black hole never comes out. But some think they may be a gateway to other universes.
Hey, can it open a pretzel bag for me? Help a brother out, BH. Woohoo! Ow!
Guys, stop throwing things in the hole! The more you throw in, the bigger and more dangerous it becomes!
Come on, you can't look at that infinitely dense little guy and not want to feed it something.
Welcome back to Star Talk Radio. I'm your host, Neil deGrasse Tyson. For this show, we're featuring my interview with the actor Hank Azaria. In this segment, we start off by discussing The Simpsons. His work on this long-running animated series has earned him 3 Academy Awards. This hugely popular show is not only a platform for his amazing voice talent, but the show often plays with science topics and concepts. How many voices are you in The Simpsons?
I'm 20 or 30 regular running characters.
What?
20 to 30?
Yeah, of guys you'll pretty much see.
And they're delineated and you can nail them each time.
Of course, yeah, those definitely. Since I created those are easy.
You got them.
Yeah, those are simple.
And this, you haven't been investigated for schizophrenia or anything? Is there some word that psychologists have for you?
As much as I often joke, like, oh, there's a lot of voices in my head or different personalities, that's never an issue. Besides the voice thing, I do consider myself a character actor, and I consider it a compliment. People have said I tend to disappear in roles and this and that, mm-hmm. vocally and otherwise. And I think that is true psychologically of me. Like, I tend to get very into whatever it is I'm doing to an extent where I'm almost like, am I the same person that I was 3 months ago before I was doing this? That's happened to me sometimes, but I've never...
But that's a good thing for an actor.
I suppose so, but yeah. Sometimes the line gets a little blurred in not such a good way, where I'm like, huh. I can remember being a teenager when you don't have these things sorted out, and I fit in with so many different peer groups. I could hang with the tough kids because I could kind of talk like, yeah, them. Yeah. Yo, what's up, dude?
That's why I didn't have you in a prep school growing up. That's why.
Yes, mm-hmm. but then with the nerdy kids, I'd be happy to talk Star Trek, and mm-hmm. that accent was gone. And then as a teenager, you sort of wonder who you really are, almost to like a weird degree. Then you kind of realize, oh, I can just kind of be a bit of a chameleon. And I found a way to do that professionally, which was a nice outlet for it. But I never like get weird, like, am I Chief Wiggum? I never like think I'm Chief Wiggum or something. I never like wig out like
that's what I'm trying to investigate here. That's the whole point of this interview.
No, that's never happened.
I've been paid by the American Psychological Society to
sometimes
probe.
I feel close to Mo. Sometimes I do. Because I feel he's from Queens, he's got a New York accent. And I used to bartend.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like if I didn't get The Simpsons, I'd probably still be a bartender.
Okay. So were you there from the beginning?
From the beginning of the half hour version.
Oh, so it started as a 15-minute.
As a little insert. Tiny, like, minute or two.
Oh, it's only a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
And what, the Tracy Ullman show?
Exactly.
Right, right. Yeah. So how quickly after that? It goes a half hour and then they find you.
Actually, they had hired somebody else to do the voice of Mo, and I thought for years they weren't happy with his work. But I found out not long ago from Matt Groening that his work was fine. He was an abrasive personality.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't like it. Poor guy. I mean, he made I owe him a debt of gratitude, but they just didn't like him. They were very meticulous in the first few years, but we'd have to do a lot of takes. And I guess he got frustrated, and I guess he was the voice of G.I. Joe. And he went, you know, when I do G.I. Joe, we never do this many.
Oh, there it is.
Like, yeah. So it was like, okay, well, we'll see you, G.I. yeah. Joe.
Keep being G.I. Joe. So I have to ask you a crass question.
Yeah.
If you're 20 to 30 characters on The Simpsons, do you get like 20 to 30 separate character paychecks for that?
No, I wish. I am not paid like by the yard.
That's
no.
What I was wondering. Yeah, yeah.
No, they get the whole thing. They get
it's
my
package.
They're paid for my time. I'm paid for my time.
So it's a package. It's you.
Yeah.
Give me this voice in this minute, the other voice the next minute.
There are some I don't think there's ever been an episode where I've done less than like 5, mm-hmm. and there's some I've done like 30 or something.
Okay.
And I've done, by the way, more voices than that. There's just 20 or 30 ones that appear very regularly. Over the 25 years, I've
probably... Who's the convenience store guy? Is that you?
That's Apu. That Apu, is me, yes. Apu Nasa Pima Petalan. He's his name. And he is a proud Indian. And he works, this is a little known fact, he works 24 hours a day. Very difficult schedule.
It's a 24-hour convenience store.
He is there 24 hours a day. And he works 24 hours a day. And he has 8 children now. So it's very difficult for him.
So when you're in the sound studio, what kind of stuff do they make you do? In other words, when we think of actors getting into character, that takes a little... psychological
right.
effort, and they get into character, and then you can draw from it. But you're so many characters. Do you ever have to go back and forth from one to another?
You mean like talking to each other?
Yeah.
All the time.
That's got to be hard.
It was a little hard at the first couple of years. I've had a lot of practice at this now. But now it really, especially with characters you're so familiar with, you know, for Apu to talk to Mo, hey, shut up, Apu. Why don't you be quiet yourself? Because I don't feel like being quiet. Hey, somebody is a little bit feisty today. Oh, feisty. That's, what is that, an American word you learned? For me, you know, once I have the voice, the whole, like, character falls in. So I don't know why
that is. Intonations and word selection.
I'd be interested
selection.
To hear what a scientist, like, police chief Wiggum talks like this. And you notice I have to put him at the side of my mouth. I don't know why. And he's really dumb, police chief Wiggum. And somehow, if I talk like this, I just feel a lot stupider than I am.
So what you're saying is, so you, the voice creates the psychological state of the character.
For me, it does. The whole body and psyche will follow if I click into a voice.
Because it's not going to work if words get swapped that would be more common with one character than another, or phrasings or anything. So
yes.
Yeah. Otherwise, you'd fail at your job.
Exactly. So, and I don't know, it just, for me, once, it's like a shortcut with acting, like, because actors will sort of build characters from the ground up. How does he walk? What was his history like? What traumatized him? What does he really want? If I can find the voice that works, like, a lot of that will just get filled in all of a sudden.
Because when you were imitating Woody Allen, you got that meek posturing, and you're...
You have to, you know, yes, you have to clear your throat a lot, too. Because, you know, he, you know, what he does.
The Simpsons is legendary for many reasons, including the frequent reference to science and math.
Yeah.
And maybe frequent is not the right word. When there are such references, they are real and meaningful.
Yeah.
Who is that primarily? Who's putting that in there?
There's been a few guys over the years, but, you know, most of these guys, or a lot of them, many of them have been there from the beginning. They're Harvard guys, and they're really, really smart. And to a lot of these guys, who is it specifically? I know that I'm pretty sure George Meyer used to put in a few of those. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure who on the current staff we have to thank.
One of my favorite episodes was it The Simpsons in 3D or something?
Yes.
And there's a grid that opens up in the, and it's one of these black hole. The black hole starts forming in the grid, and Homer is sliding down, and he says, "Oh, I knew I should have read that book by that wheelchair guy," because he doesn't know what's going on.
Oh, wow.
And there's a street sign that has Euler's equation on it, which is a profound, almost spiritual expression of mathematics.
It's right.
E to the power I pi equals -1. That was on a street sign. You don't just pull that out of your ass.
No.
Somebody did some homework for that episode.
Well, Al Jean, who's been running the show for years, I'm sure he's had a lot to do with many of these. And he's an interesting guy, because more than anybody I've ever met, more than any other comedy writer I've ever met, comedy is like math to him. It's this, like, the script becomes this equation that he's figured out that pays off in the right places and sort of works as it is on paper. As a result, sometimes it's a little bit frustrating for us voice actors who want to deviate from that a little bit. Like, we'll improvise something and it'll, like, snap him out as if you've changed the line of the equation.
Can't mess with the equation.
Exactly. Mm. And so he'll have to sort of wrap his brain around it.
You know, I never thought of it that way, because what is a joke but an equation with an equal sign at the end?
Pretty much. It certainly is to Al, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he's almost a savant like that with the comedy.
But otherwise, how much latitude do you have if you say, well, my character wouldn't say it that way, he'd say it this other way? Do they give you that space? I mean, you're an old-timer now, for they've got to give you some space.
Yes, but I always try to give them a couple exactly as written, and then I do a couple where I play around.
And then they can decide.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, they let them decide in editing. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of dealer's choice. Different showrunners, some of them really embrace all the different stuff, and people, Al is more like, no, this is how I worked it out. So as long as it's good, I don't. By the way, did I ever tell you the story of, you know, when...
this is only the second time we've met, so the answer is probably no.
I might have told you it at the airport when I saw you about... I think I might did, but I'll tell again here.
So we met at the airport. This was our third time together. We met on the street.
Yes.
And I was my own business.
You did my show.
You stuck a camera in my face.
I did.
What's it like being a dad? I'm like, what?
You gave us such great... Did you see any of those?
I did. No, it was great. It was great.
You gave us such great stuff.
Uh-huh.
I told you about how, when Stephen Hawking visited us. I told you about this, didn't I?
No, no.
I guess he was a fan of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to come to our table read. And we were all
just so I know what that is.
That's when we read the script for the first time.
And around you table. Feel it and shake it out.
Mostly it's for the writers. They hear it and they'll do their rewrite based on how it just sounded.
Mm-hmm.
We do that on a Thursday and we record the show on a Monday. They'll rewrite on Friday and then we'll...
Mm-hmm.
So they're tradition. We've been doing them for a long time now. We usually get about 50 to 100 people watching them because it's kind of an event. It's fun. So Stephen Hawking was coming. So we're all very, very excited by this. And he's late. 10 minutes late. 20 minutes late.
He's not late. Time has just not...
Well, here's what...
He's on time. The rest of the universe
that's
was
where,
early.
That's where I'm headed here.
Okay.
So he's significantly late. And there's this Hollywood thing where... When important people are late in Hollywood, first you don't mention it, and then after about 20 minutes in hushed tones, the well, what do you want? Should we start? What should happen? So that debate kind of starts, and we're like, well, do we start? Do we just go? I mean, and it's kind of going back and forth, and Harry Shearer is reading his newspaper, and without looking up from his newspaper, he just chimes in, does the man have no concept of time?
That is great.
It's a good one. I think it might be the funniest line I've ever heard anybody say.
Ever.
About anything, yeah.
Ever.
Does the man have no concept of time? But he appeared in the show,
mm-hmm.
Stephen Hawking,
mm-hmm.
actually. I think maybe just one episode.
So the list of scientists, which apparently doesn't include me.
Really? I can't believe we haven't.
I don't want to sound jealous or anything.
That's amazing.
But I just thought I'd let someone on the cast know.
I'll put in a word.
No, that's fine. No, it's too late. Too late.
That's not too late. It's hardly too late.
The only thing we now that I've done Cosmos, okay? What kind of bard I needed to get noticed by you guys? So you've had Stephen Jay Gould.
Yeah.
He was in an episode. I think it adds a certain fun credibility.
There's a lot of really mathematical and science Easter eggs, I guess, as they call them,
mm-hmm.
as they put in the show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was an interesting article about that recently, about how there's a lot for math geeks to hang on to.
Yeah. Also, I remember an episode where, Homer discovers a comet? I might have the details wrong. And it's named after him. But then they find out that the comet is headed towards Earth, and so then they blame him.
I don't even remember this one.
It's one of these mob scenes with torches,
okay.
and they burn down the observatory. And it's a statement of people's sense of the cause and effect of things.
Yeah, the whole mob mentality theme is a big one in The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
Just how the psychology of mobs and how they can turn and how easily influenced they are.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of their really good social satire things that they do.
So... you were in a show called Huff.
Yes.
And you played a psychiatrist.
That's right.
Okay.
That was about 8-9 years ago.
Uh-huh. How did that go?
That was great. Mm-hmm. I loved that show. It was hard to do because it was about a lot of difficult emotional things.
Because mm-hmm. what I always wonder, you have an ensemble of actors, and many of them are playing, let's just call them for the moment, regular people.
Yeah.
You know, husband, wife, and then there's some... actor that has to now play a learned person in the midst of that group.
Right.
And they go to that learned person to get something explained. It's a different role in a group of actors, right?
It is, and it was often a little more boring.
Yeah, because you don't get to emote like everybody else does.
No, I would be sort of, you know, we would see a lot of his sessions as a psychiatrist, and mm-hmm. I'd be sitting there going, my lines would be, mm-hmm. Really? Well, why did you feel that way? While people were doing these astonishing monologues, these emotional monologues, we're like, uh-huh, okay. Well, I'll see you next time. But a lot of the show was about how... That show was a lot about, really, about addiction, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in that show was addicted to something. Mm-hmm. Even though it didn't purport to be that, that's really what it was about. And it was definitely about how a guy who could know what was good for everybody else and fix their lives had no clue when it came to his own life.
Yeah, that's a common fact.
Absolutely.
From what I read. Yeah.
Had a big blind spot for his own codependencies and addictions and whatnot.
So you were in Futurama.
I would play Zoidberg's uncle. The voice was kind of like this, and it was like an old Jewish comedian, which was sort of based on Georgie Jessel. Remember Georgie Jessel?
No.
Yeah, why would you know him? But he was a comedian from like the 50s, 60s, who talked like this, Georgie Jessel.
You're in a series of animated shows that have huge geek following.
Yeah.
So you must be sort of a demigod at Comic-Con.
You know, I've never gone, and I'm dying to go. And I'm a big comic book geek and sci-fi geek.
You've never been to Comic-Con?
Never been. I'm dying
to go.
And
now they opened one up in New York.
I would venture to say that I will definitely go to that.
Yeah, because as you know, the geek following is probably the most loyal following.
Yeah.
And they'll hold you to stuff.
What do you mean?
Not just blindly loyal fans. If you're not true to a character or you step out of it in they'll be on your
case. That's like comic book guy, the role I play on The Simpsons. He will often bust people on, excuse me, in episode 8F09, you had a white dog, and yet in episode 4F12, the dog was tan. How do you explain this discrepancy? That's comic book guy.
And they'll exist, you know. So in your Comic-Con universe geek credentials, you also voiced something in Spider-Man? What was that?
I was Eddie Brock, who was another New Yorker. Eddie Brock kind of talked like this. And then Venom. He became Venom.
He a nemesis of Spider-Man?
Venom, yeah. He's a pretty cool nemesis. Remember when Spider-Man got that black suit for a while?
Yeah.
That was actually an alien symbiote. He just found the suit and it enhanced his powers. But he found that he was losing control of himself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the alien was kind of taking over and making him do bad things. And he couldn't get rid of it. Like, it wouldn't leave him. And he got it off him by sort of somehow it glommed onto Eddie Brock. And it kind of combined with who you really were. So when he was Spider-Man, Peter Parker was such a good guy that he was only kind of...
It added aspects of his personality profile.
It was making Peter Parker do stuff he didn't like, but it wasn't horrible. But Eddie Brock was kind of a bad dude.
To begin with.
Yes. And he also had not a very strong will, so the alien completely took him over and was this awful character named Venom.
And that was you.
That was me. Yeah.
So in your resume, is it sectioned by awful, reprehensible characters, lovable characters? What does your resume look like?
A wide range. It's upon request.
Your theory of a donut-shaped universe is intriguing, Homer. I may have to steal it.
Wow, I can't believe someone I never heard of is hanging out with a guy like me.
All right, it's closing time. Who's paying the tab?
I am.
I didn't say that.
Yes, I did.
But I have to go. I can't miss my flight.
Are you sure? I'll bet there's another flight to Manskin.
July. Pochalusta pochisti moimernich stoka.
It's really beautiful. What does it mean?
Please clean my beakers. I don't get out of the lab much.
Welcome back to Star Talk Radio. I'm your host, Neil deGrasse Tyson. We've been featuring my interview with the actor Hank Azaria. In this final segment, we have a free-ranging discussion about his roles in the movie Godzilla, the TV show Friends, and his new animated series on Fox. We also bring it back to Star Trek to answer the age-old geek question, Kirk or Picard?
Forgive me, I was never a fan of the show Friends.
Okay, I forgive you.
It wasn't popular up in the hood, you know.
Okay.
It wasn't one of those kind of shows.
I can understand that.
But you were a recurring character.
I was.
And you played a scientist.
I did.
Yeah.
David the Scientist Guy, that's what they called him.
That doesn't have the same ring as Bill Nye the Science Guy.
No.
That's like a lame imitation of that, right? So did you have to do any homework for that?
I did not.
I applaud your honesty in front of this audience.
It was never I was required to be funny and be believably geeky.
Uh-huh.
And that's about as far as the science went.
And you had enough natural geek in you to
very
to play
easy.
That.
I put on glasses.
Yeah.
You know,
that was a little studious look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I'm alone in saying that in the 1998 Godzilla, I really liked your role because it felt like you were just trying to get the shot, you know? And you were the cameraman, news cameraman.
Yes, that was a tough movie on a lot of levels. It didn't come out as well as we wanted it to.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't do as well as we wanted it to. It became the symbol of like what was wrong with Hollywood at that moment. These kind of overblown budgets that didn't deliver and were just kind of rehashing stuff that had already been done in a way not as well. It was tough for me because I thought that, you know, these guys had just done Independence Day, which was a huge, huge success. And we were all in that cast hoping for the same kind of success. And it actually had kind of more of a negative impact. But yes,
well, I enjoyed it.
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, yeah.
I heard the newer one was better.
I haven't seen that yet.
I haven't seen it either with Bryan Cranston.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that said, the other thing about that was we shot that for about 5 months. And Roland Emmerich directed it, and he's a German guy, and he came to me one day, he said, so we got a great idea, we're going to do everything in the rain. Always going to be raining, the creature is going to look better in the rain, it's going to be beautiful. I'm like, great. And
Now that you mention it, right? I don't remember seeing the sun at all.
Pouring. The problem with that
dark
is,
and dank.
I told that at the time I wasn't married to her yet, but I was going out with Helen Hunt, who was a pro, had done everything under the sun as an actress already. And I told her that, and she was like,
"Oh, can I boast?
What?
She came to this office.
Oh yeah,
and sat in that chair.
Oh yeah,
and
did she do the show?
I coached her. No,
oh.
Before Star Talk, long in the early 90s and late 90s, and I coached her on how to be the wife of an astrophysicist in a play that she was starring in Broadway.
Oh,
it was called Lifetimes 3.
Yes.
And it had John Turturro in it,
yes.
And Data was in it.
Oh, Brent Spiner.
Brent Spiner.
He's in this season of Ray Donovan. He plays a shrink, actually.
Oh, okay. All right.
This season of Ray
but
Donovan.
I had all three of them in this office, and I'm telling them about how to be an astrophysicist. That was just fun.
That is fun.
That was a little charming moment. Okay, but go on. So you were dating her.
We were dating at the time, and I told her that it's going to be all in the rain. And she was like, oh, no, that's terrible. I'm like, it won't be so bad. She's like, okay, I hope not. And
she's thinking, you idiot.
Well, every exterior pouring down. And Hollywood rain it's like a deluge, so the camera will see it. It was so miserable. We all got sick like multiple times. We had to wear wetsuits.
You know, that's an interesting point, because in a baseball game, when it starts to rain, the camera doesn't pick up the rain.
Often doesn't.
Yeah.
It has to be lit. Correct.
It's got a lit in the right way from behind. It's got a glow.
It's
got
to be pretty thick.
Yeah. I hadn't thought that through.
Yeah. So
you had a wetsuit under your clothing.
That would be soaked through. The wetsuit would be soaked through by lunchtime. You had to change wetsuits.
Mm.
Okay. And the hardest part was...
And then Helen Hunt broke up with you because you were an idiot.
Well, not long after that. I got soggy. She was like, enough with you. Oh, it was terrible. 3 weeks of night shooting in the rain in downtown L.A., and we'd be suffering through this going, okay, it's going to be worth it. But when it comes out, and it wasn't.
Well, my favorite rain line, I don't remember if you were in the car, but they're trying to drive uptown.
Yeah.
And they get on the on-ramp to the FDR Drive. And they say, let's take the FDR Drive. And meanwhile, Godzilla is bearing down on the city. And she says, everyone knows you're not supposed to drive on the FDR in the rain.
It had its moments.
Yeah, it was like, that was a very New York urban joke.
Yes.
It's you don't drive on the FDR when it's raining, because there's no shoulder, it's slippery,
right.
One accident takes out that stuff forever. So, but back to Star Trek briefly. So, I've got to ask you, Kirk or Picard?
Oh boy, you know, I would have always said Kirk, and then about 9-10 years ago, I binge-watched all of Next Generation and really loved it, and now it's a tough call for me. I think I have to go Kirk. Push comes to shove, I gotta go Kirk.
I'm Kirk too. Not that I don't love me some Picard.
Yeah, he's
who doesn't
great.
Love Picard? But Kirk had a certain seat of the pants.
Yeah.
I mean, Picard doesn't
making. Fight.
I mean... Well, was he never in a fight?
I don't think ever.
Oh my gosh!
I don't think one time did he ever sock an alien in the jaw.
Kirk fought the Gorn.
Exactly.
If you can fight lizard aliens.
Yeah! I used to love the Gorn. Ben Stiller's a buddy of mine. He is the proud owner of the Gorn head.
No.
The actual Gorn.
So the head is out there.
Oh, yeah. Ben dragged me once to like an auction of all these crazy things. He's a huge Star Trek fan and collector.
Wait a minute. That wouldn't have been the Christie's auction, but about 10 years ago.
It was.
7 years ago. I was at that auction.
Oh, you were there?
I didn't buy anything. That was expensive.
It was.
They had the foam phaser that would be on the hip of the stunt people so that when they fell, they wouldn't be impaled by the real phaser.
Right.
That went for $150.
Yeah.
I said, no, I can't, you know, I'm done here. I'll just watch.
I don't know what he paid for the Gorn head, but I think it was a lot.
That's a great sentence. What did the Gorn head go for? So you said you'd take Kirk over Picard.
I would.
You know why I take Kirk over Picard?
Why?
One reason.
Why?
One reason. There was an episode, forgive me for not remembering the name of the episode.
I bet I know it.
Where he is threatening some Klingon vessel, and their deflector shields are damaged.
Right.
The Enterprise, and their photon torpedo can't shoot. There's something wrong, and they actually can't defend themselves.
Right.
And so Kirk tells them, if you don't back the hell up, I'm paraphrasing, of course, but if you don't care, we will do something, okay? And we will knock you out of the water. And I got all the details wrong, but the sense of this is accurate.
I know all
And Spock says, Captain, this is no time for a game of chess. And he says, Spock, it's not chess. It's poker.
It's poker.
And I said, holy, that's my man right there. That making executive decision.
Is called the Corbomite Maneuver. And that's the device that he claims to have on board is Corbomite, which is a self-destruct mechanism that would take out space all around the Enterprise, including the ship that was threatening them. The Corbomite Maneuver is the title of that episode.
Thank you. And since there was no such thing as a Corbomite,
no,
he just made it up.
Totally made it up. It's a bluff.
And the other folks don't know it.
Right.
And Spock doesn't know anything about bluffing.
Right.
And so I thought that was just a brilliant move.
That's it was great.
I want to be Kirk.
I remember, great ep. They, at one point, the aliens. It wasn't the Klingons. I think it was
Romulans.
It might. No, it was like just a some one-time other alien. Like one, Tholians,
one,
I think.
One-time alien.
Yes, it was. They only made a one-time appearance. And it was that. You know what? It ended up being. Remember, they got visual contact, and it was that really scary alien.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when they finally went on board, it was that little kid.
Oh yeah.
Which happened? Which was Ron Howard's little brother.
That was the same episode. Howard. That was the same episode.
It turns out that they aren't these scary aliens. It was just they were actually faking too. I think that's the the same episode.
Mm-hmm.
And they at one point he says, please show us proof that you have this Corbomite device. And they're gonna and Uhura's gonna answer. He goes, no, wait. Let him sweat it out a little bit.
Mm.
Doesn't answer right away. You know, that's all poker. And then he just clicks on it and goes, request denied. and he cuts off.
Hits the button.
That's the same as me saying, come on, let me see your hole cards. I'm saying, no.
It's poker.
Yeah.
Poker, that's life.
Yeah. Yeah. Captain Kirk.
So what's next for you?
I'm working on this. I just finished the season of Ray Donovan on Showtime, which just started airing.
So you are Showtime property at this point? I mean, these are your gigs of latest gigs.
Property of, well, that, you know, I've done two, so I guess I'm part of the family at this point.
Well, it's got good ads. So, I mean, the ads are out. So
they do. Mm-hmm. I love cable series. There, I think I love them because I like. This is a crime show, and I love crime fiction and. These shows, they last, they're able to be so realistic and they go for so long and they get so into the character, they're like reading a book almost. You feel like you've just read a good novel.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got a new cartoon coming on Fox called Border Town.
Well, you don't have enough cartoons, to your credit?
They came and I said, all right, sure, why not? This is Seth MacFarlane and a guy named Mark Henteman. These guys did Family Guy for a long time.
As you know, Seth was executive producer on Cosmos.
I did know that.
Yeah.
I did see
that. And he, not many people know this because we didn't make a big deal of it. In our first episode, when we had Giordano Bruno, one of our heroes of our storytelling, Seth was the voice.
Oh, really?
Of Giordano Bruno. Oh, yeah.
Really?
Very sensitive read. I mean, it was great. And that's the same person who does Peter Griffin, right? Or Stewie. So we were delighted to see that range.
He's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
He's
mm-hmm.
pretty amazing.
So this cartoon is what you say?
It's called Border Town.
Mm-hmm.
And what
role does Seth have in it?
Seth is just executive producer.
He's executive producer. Mm-hmm.
He's really just shepherding it.
And where's it going to air?
On Fox.
On Fox,
It'll be on probably next spring.
That's right. Simpsons is a Fox.
It is.
Yeah.
As is Family Guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty out there.
Mm-hmm.
Dare I say this character I play is the most racist character since, I think, Archie Bunker.
Really?
I think I can say that with confidence.
Is he lovably racist?
Not particularly.
Okay.
I mean, he's funny,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, like Archie Bunker, he's meant to be, or like Colbert, he's meant to be so extreme that he's a fool.
That he's a caricature.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And is supposed to point up, you know, what's awful and ridiculous about this guy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's you know how Family Guy doesn't really pull any punches?
Well, I think they get away with it because they have other characters that critique it in the same show.
That's exactly like...
That's how you clean your hands on that.
Very much the same in this show.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Interesting.
But it's funny.
So, yeah, good luck with that.
Thank you.
Hank, thanks.
Thank you, it was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Star Talk Radio, brought to you in part by a grant from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson. And as always, I urge you, until next time, to keep looking up.